My name's Chris Raymer. I'm an alcoholic. Yes. Got sober November 13th, 87. And I'm blown away by this group. This looks like something I would build. I guess the 9th anniversary, and we did it, I don't even remember what room we did it in, but it was like this table's worth of people right here, and it's like every year this thing just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's an awesome thing to watch. I am blown away. I know so many of you in this room, and I'm honored that you came out in this stupid weather to visit with us and help us celebrate this group's anniversary. 14 years is it's a pretty cool thing. I want to talk about a few things tonight, and as always, I think I need to get into this thing, kind of ease into it. I don't want to make anybody cranky. I'm gonna, but I don't want to. I spent the better part of the last couple of years traveling, speaking. I was building my little date planner a while back, and spent about 40 weekends out of the year last year traveling, doing little talks here and there, some local, some out of country. And there's certain parts of the country that ask me back quite often. There's certain parts of the country I can't go back to. And it always blows me away, you know, and I think there's some in here that have not heard me speak before, and I welcome. I have some wonderful, my best friends in the world are in this room right now. I got to tell you, I know some people in here that I would die for, literally. And some of you people that I'm going to meet tonight will be a part of that group. And some of you people will smile very cordially after I finish speaking and shake my hand. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And you'll walk out of the doors with the little... And then you'll take my inventory all the way to Denny's and all the way to the coffee shop. And then tomorrow, all over Dallas, Fort Worth area, in the meeting.
Well, I heard this little asshole in primary purpose group last night telling us what we could share in meetings, what we couldn't share in meetings. I'm going to tell you right now, the most controversial thing I'm going to say from the podium, I'm going to say right now and get it out of the way. I'm just going to say it. We're going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about primary purpose tonight. I'm not necessarily the group, but our primary purpose, our fifth tradition. I'm going to talk a little bit about this. I'm going to tell you point blank right now, and I'll take exception with anybody that wants to play this game with me. It is not your right to share anything you want in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah.
I can't tell you. I have this effect on mics. I don't know what it is. It looks like my thing sometimes. Come on, baby. Work. I know, really. Holy moly. Having said that, we'll get it out of the way and just get on down the road. See, I need to tell you where I'm coming from. And as always, anytime I speak or any of my tapes, a lot of you guys have never heard me speak, but you've heard my roads of Texas are littered with my tapes. And now they're littered with my CDs. And the CDs are out there everywhere now, too. You know, and you can see them. You know, if you're working the program and you're active in the fellowship, you love this stuff. You listen to them before you go into meetings and then go in there and shoot people and stuff. And it's great. But if you're not working the program, you find them very, very offensive. And let me tell you what I'm doing. This is my nickel up here. Y'all have asked me to come up here and speak and participate and that's what I'm going to do. And anything I'm going to share from this podium, guys, you can take it or leave it. I mean, I'm down with that. But I'm a chronic relapser, and I've talked about this 1,000 times. It was interesting when Cliff said, how many of you guys have more than one sobriety date? it's like all these hands went up. We looked like we were doing the wave out here. You know, it's like, but you know, but that is inherently what the problem is. You see, because this program was designed so that you could come in here, hear the solution, and not ever drink again. But you see, when I first came to this fellowship in 1980, up in North Texas, 81, I guess, in North Texas, I didn't hear the solution. There's two things going on here. You hear me talk a lot about it. There's the fellowship, that's this room, and then there's the program. You with us? The program is a thing called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the 164 pages that Primary Purpose studies when they meet. on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturday nights. This is what they study. This is the literature. But you see, in 1980 or 81, whenever it was, I've missed a whole decade here, guys. I don't know. I mean, this drinking almost killed me. And when I went to these meetings, what I heard was not the program. What I heard was the fellowship. And there was nothing wrong with the fellowship. There were people in that room that loved me and cared whether I got sober. And they were happy, some of them, you know. But the message that was going to change my life was not shared with me. And that's the only place that I'm coming from. I do clerical work at a treatment center, folks, and I am on the firing line of this disease on a daily basis. I'm not a counselor or a therapist. I won't license because the minute I do, it will color the way I can talk to a drunk. And the day that I can't get in front of a drunk and say, "You're the most selfish, self-centered son of a bitch on earth," is the day I need to go someplace else. Y'all follow what I'm saying? No, we got to get straight here, guys, because that's the root of our problem. It says on page 62, the root of my problem is that I'm so selfish, I think I'm the only one that's right in the place. You know, I understand you nice people need to work the steps, but you know, my case is a little different. But you see, but that's what nearly killed me. That's what nearly killed me. Because until I do the things necessary to get connected to God, I'm not going to have this thing called a necessary spiritual experience. And if I don't have the spiritual experience, folks, I'm not going to get sober. I'm going to mention this right now, folks, because I know that there's a lot of you in here that are duly diagnosed. And we're here in an AA meeting. We're going to talk about alcohol. We're not going to talk about those other, as Glenda would say, those other issues. But I'm going to tell you, folks, if you happen to be addicted to one of those other issues and you are in these fellowships messing around with it, you're going to die. You're going to die. And there's a lot of laughter in this room. There's a lot of fun in this program. But underneath is the absolute certainty that you are going to continue. If the desire to drink or do those other things stays with me, I'm going to do it. This idea, folks, please, this idea that we hear in treatment, that you can somehow magically keep yourself sober, is so ludicrous. It's hard for me even to... Because the book is quite... Why? Perhaps let's just go to that textbook. Here's one of the reasons that I couldn't stay sober. Now, some of you cats, y'all heard me read some of this before, and so I'm gonna touch real quickly on a page or two that I find quite useful. Oh, this is too good. On page 155, and there's a little chapter called "A Vision for You." Okay, it's pretty cool. You know, it's one of the best chapters in the thing. Some of you got your books; you can read it. It's where Bill Wilson's talking about making his first approach. He was doing a 12-step call on this cat named Dr. Bob, right? Co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, proctologist extraordinaire, so I understand. So the sentence says, y'all got to see the humor in this. I mean, this is where we got our roots, buddy. An out-of-work stockbroker and a butt doctor. I mean, I've said it, but I mean, I love it. God's laughing big, I tell you. Here's what it says on page 155. It says, he had a desperate desire. Let me check my time real quick, make sure. I don't want to run over. He had a desperate desire to stop. He's talking about Dr. Bob, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape, painfully aware of being somehow abnormal. Duh. The man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. Now, I'm going to submit something to you that most of you, I can't say in this group, but a lot of people that I do talks in front of aren't fully aware of what it is to be alcoholic. They're quite aware of what it is to be a problem drinker. They got a pretty good idea what it feels like to have their butt on fire and knowing that if it doesn't get put out pretty quick, they're going to jail. You know what I'm saying? They're going to get divorced. They're going to lose their babies. They understand what the pain of this disease has caused them around them. But they don't fully understand what it is to be an alcoholic. And this is the tragedy in our fellowships, is that we don't have enough people in our fellowships trying to convey that message, because we're too busy talking about... Don't do it. People come to the hospital and say, "Well, Chris, we'd like to hear one of your tapes, but we don't want any with a cussing on it." And I just kind of look at them like, I don't, can you edit it? I don't know what to tell you. We're too busy talking about everybody else's issues. And this is why this gets so controversial. We got a fellowship of men and women who have squeaked under the door by coming in using AA as a therapy group. And they've managed to put some sobriety together. So they assume that the poor schmuck behind them should be able to do it. We don't even know if they're real alcoholics, so do we? The traditions that we read in front of every meeting, everybody reads them, and they go, yes, this is a great group. We adhere to the traditions. We read the traditions. We're such a great group. We're such a great group. And then they open the open discussion meeting, and then the first thing out of their stupid mouth is, well, who's got the problem? Geez, didn't we just read a tradition that says that we were here to talk about one thing and one thing only, and that's your problem with alcohol? And now we're going to open it up so we can talk about anything under the sun? And then we wonder why people don't stay in our fellowship. Why should they? They came here to recover from alcoholism. And all they did was hear you talk about your stupid divorce one more time. Oh, shit. And this is, I mean, I'm going to read this to you, but I mean, this is why this is so controversial when I speak from the podium. I just did an anniversary talk south a town here not long ago, and we talked about this same stuff. And I'm going to tell you something, folks. There was no laughter in that room. When I'm talking like this, there's dead silence, and they are not happy with what I've got to say. Because if you look at the schedule, it's nothing but open discussion meetings. It's a format to come talk about your stupid problems. And then what happens is, after the meeting, everybody comes up to the stuff that we just talked about, and a nice little girl out there says, well, I just love what you had to say. And I'm watching her, and it's just, except for one or two points. I'm just looking, because she's going to tell me, I don't have to ask her, she's going to explain to me what points she didn't like about the talk. Well, this piece about not being able to share your problems of the day. I mean, I realize that we just have these problems, and we just need a place to come share that. And I just, you know, I mean, this is so ingrained in our fellowship. It's just like heresy when you say that it is not okay to come in and belly. I mean, you ought to stand up here and look at you right now. Some of you are catching flies. It's like, how can this little skinny guy stand up there and say that it's not okay to talk about my problems in meetings? It's real easy. I'll say it again. It's not okay to talk about your problems in meetings. Unbelievable. On page, I jotted this down. On page 25, bottom of the page on page 25, we're going to go real quick here. Guys, don't worry about this. We're going to turn this into a step study. It's one of my favorite lines, and it says, talks about no middle-of-the-road solution. But it says, if we had passed into this region, let me read the whole paragraph. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if, underline it if you got your book, if we had passed into the region for which there was no return through human aid. And Bill Wilson is giving us a choice here. If you can get sober on a non-spiritual basis, then go do it. If what you need is some good therapy and a pat on the butt and go back to the gym and change your diet and eat an antidepressant, then just go do that. And then just don't drink anymore. And if you can do that, hallelujah, but you're not an alcoholic. Because the book, real clear here on page 25, says real clear, if there's no return through human aid, we have but two alternatives. One was to go on the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, that means keep drinking, or as best we could, or the other was to accept spiritual help. You with us? One of the most powerful lines in the book is this one right here, and I'll quit reading for a minute so you guys don't have your book wake up again. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're on page 34. We're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Now, there's a bunch of you in this room that are alcoholics and addicts in this room. You're in and out of AA 1,000 times. The bottom line is you don't want to stop. You want people to get off your butt. You want the pain to go away, but you're not going to quit taking them drugs. You're not going to stop drinking. Have a nice life. And Bill Wilson understands that. He's saying point blank. Guys, if you want to, okay, here it is. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he's going to do this or not. Power of choice. Didn't say a dadgum thing about whether or not my wife was going to come back or not. Didn't say anything about whether I got the kids or whether the adoption came through or whether I got the money or I solved my little childhood of origin issues. It said point blank this, that if you're an alcoholic and an addict, there's only one way to get sober, and that's through a means of thing called a spiritual experience. Now, our job as a group, as a fellowship, is to help you find your truth. Are you one of us or not? Guy comes into my treatment center and he goes through a 30-day deal and he leaves, he gets drunk, comes back, goes through a 30-day deal, leaves, goes, he's drunk, comes back. Third time in there, he's saying the same thing. Well, you know I'm an alcoholic. You're a liar. You're a liar. If you know you're an alcoholic, folks, if deep down inside you know you're an alcoholic, there's a line in the book that says there can be no lurking notion. And listen, folks, I'm going to tell you something. We've got a fellowship full of people that still have a lurking notion. Can't you just see this little guy, what a lurking notion looks like? Little bastard's got horns, I can tell you that. Because I had a lurking notion for 18 years. I knew at 20 years old that I was an alcoholic and an addict. Because I knew that my butt was on fire. I was drinking just like my dad. And it was jeopardizing my job, my career. I was in the food business. I was a professional chef. It was jeopardizing my health. It was certainly jeopardizing my love life. Guys, I mean, we laugh about it all the time. My brother one time, he finally just said, "Chris, you need to stop bringing your girlfriends over to the house. They're scaring the kids." I have a tendency to. It wasn't that I went out looking for ugly women. It wasn't like that at all. It was just that when you're so unwholesome, I mean, you know, you that's what who you attract is beasts. I don't know. But in the back of my mind, you see, in the back of my mind, there's this lurking notion that my case is different. There's a lurking notion is that and we've all done this, guys. How many of y'all have done this? As soon as I can get the debts paid off, I'll quit. As soon as I can get the real job, I'll quit. As soon as I graduate, I'll quit. As soon as we can sell the business, I'll quit. As soon as we can have children, I'll quit. And we just go, there's a lurking notion here, folks. There's a lurking notion that you're different. The truth is, guys, I had alcoholism. And we knew what the solution was back then. But I never could get the solution. Never could get that transmitted to me. Everybody wants to say, when you got here in 82, Chris, surely you must have heard the message someplace. I'd never heard the message. I never heard the message. We didn't carry big books to work, to the meetings with us. We didn't go to big book studies. We went to open discussion meetings where we talked about the issue du jour. Non-stop. Let me get this real quick. What is an alcoholic? Man, if I went to the hospital where I work right now, there's 90 people on campus right now, and if I went to every single one of them and asked them, "Do you know what an alcoholic is?" Every single one of them would say, "You damn right, it's me. I'm an alcoholic." Same story, second verse. Now explain to me what an alcoholic is. Well, I've had 60 WIs. I suggest some driving courses. I don't know. Learn how to drive better. I don't know. I mean, I've been divorced. I've been this. I've been this. I've been that. You're going to tell me all of the drama that takes place after you pick up a drink. But that is not what an alcoholic is. The book is quite clear in the first pages. We spend the first 60 pages talking about what it is to be an alcoholic in order to discover whether or not we need to be here or not. You see, we've got this idea that this is some kind of social deal. That's back to the fellowship. Come join our fellowship. Let me put this a little clearer for you. Come join our fellowship if you need to be here. If you don't, go away. If you're not a member of Al-Anon or you're not an alcoholic who's suffering from this disease, go away. Because all you're doing is killing people with your stupid opinions. And you got nothing to share anyway because you can't identify with a dadgum thing that's going on in these rooms. Make sense? God, we've got 200 other 12-step groups out there to coincide with any problem you've got. You know, and if you don't happen to have a problem with alcohol, beat it. Listen, I'll tell you straight. I know there's a lot more sobriety in AA. It's a great fellowship. The women are drop-dead gorgeous. And the fellowship you can't beat. That's a fact. But I'm telling you point blank, we don't want you here if you don't need to be here. Come with me afterwards. Let's go to Denny's and be buddies. If you happen to be good-looking, my divorce was final 2 weeks ago. Let's go visit. I know, really. I'm a little rusty, but I ain't dead. So let's go. Let's get this in. But I don't need you in my meetings. I don't need you in my meetings talking crap. I don't need you in the meetings talking about where you're at today. I don't, nor does the fellowship care where you're at today. You understand this? Alcoholics Anonymous is not a process group where you're going to share where you're at. Where you're at is selfish and self-centered to the core. What we care about is where that other person's at. And he's drinking today, and he's hurting, and he needs a solution. Are you willing to pick up a book and come carry the message of hope to him? If you are, stick with us. If you're not, go away. With all the love I can muster for you, with all the love and kindness I can, just go away. We've got troubles in Alcoholics Anonymous, folks. We've got big troubles in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor says it better. We've got killing things going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got too many people coming into this fellowship believing that they can share anything they want, and they do. Only problem is that the stuff that they're sharing has got absolutely, absolutely no basis in reality with what this book tried to tell us 67 years ago. We're not going to talk about the truth. We're going to talk about somebody's stupid-ass opinions about what you need to do about your drinking or your relationships or your family or whatever. And folks, we're killing people by the thousands out there by letting it happen. Why am I such a big proponent and fan of primary purpose? Because they got one primary purpose. If any of y'all haven't noticed this little banner that stands back in the back of this room, it's got a little tree, and right in the center there is primary purpose. And then it's got all the little branches and all the little leaves of where this message is being carried back to the other treatment centers and halfway houses in the area. And folks, that's what... Can you imagine if every Alcoholics Anonymous group in Dallas, Texas would do that? Can you imagine the number of people that we could reach with a very clear message of hope? But we're too busy trying to help you have a better day so you can stay sober. Let me ask you, folks, because I'd be remiss if I did it, because I do it on every talk I've ever done in my entire life. Let me ask you cats in this room that are real alcoholics. You little disco drunks, you don't have to play with us if you don't want to. But you real alcoholics, you can play with me here. How many of you cats drank and drugged when everything was going great in your life? Pick me. How many of you were drinking and drugging when everything was going crappy in your life? When you had a lot of money. No money. Big car. Just leave them up. Isn't that what we do? It's like every day you do it. It's like if you're drinking when... There's a story in the book about Jim, the car salesman. He says, he came to work on Tuesday morning. This is the dead giveaway. What's significant about Tuesday morning? It's just another damn morning. So it's nothing significant about Tuesday morning. When did you need an excuse to drink? Drinking is not causal, folks. If something out there, your bad marriage, the health, the trauma in your life, if that's what's caused you to drink, then you need a good therapist and you need to go away. You need to go get well and go away. But if you want to... Folks, look at your truth based on your experience. Haven't things been going great in your life and you still found an excuse to go drink? And things are crappy in your life and you still got an excuse? The last thing you needed to do, friends, was go drink, but you did it anyway, didn't you? That's the disease. That's alcoholism. The big book says if you can control the crap once you put it in your body, if you can guarantee me how much you're going to drink every time, you're not one of us. Ask yourself right now, point blank, were there times that you set out to drink a couple of beers and ended up drinking half of Houston? No. Wasn't there times that you set up to drink two beers and ended up having four beers? Yeah? Then you need to really look at what we're talking about here. Because that's one of the main symptoms, this lack of control. There's a line in the book that says, it's a great obsession of every abnormal user to be able to control, some of y'all can quote it, comma, and enjoy your drinking. How many of you guys have ever been asked to control it? You got a wife sitting next to you kicking you right now. Yes. I told you. Yeah. And did you enjoy it? Myers remembers some of you. I remember my first wife. It was here in Denton when I first got sober, or tried to get sober. She was long gone by the time I got sober. But when she went to a therapist and counselor, and the counselor said, the reason Chris gets drunk is because he drinks too fast. I would do it. Because that's the truth. And your body will metabolize alcohol at a certain rate. And so if you could slow your drinking down and let drink, she had it figured out, Chris, that you can have one drink an hour and your body will metabolize it and you won't get squashed. You follow me? I honest to God, this is it. And she had a little timer little stopwatch. And we go to a party. She was a hairdresser. She's as sweet as can be. And she, we go to a party, and it was, and she would go, okay. And I look at the beard. I look at her like that, and she would go, click. Y'all think I'm kidding? And you know, all night long, I'm sitting there drinking beer, and all I can hear is this, click, 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 click. And you hear tick tock. It's like Captain Hook deal. You know, it's like tick. Tick, tock, and I can hear it all over the room because I know, and I'm watching the clock, and I can't get it, and I'm gradually irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, I'm so pissed, and everybody else is drinking, and everybody else, we have to leave. They're doing cocaine in the back room. We have to get out of here before we get arrested. Now, come on, guys, if I was, I'd be back there with them. But because I can't drink and drug like I want to, because I'm timing it now, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. Greater possession of every abnormal user to be able to control and enjoy his drinking. I can control it, and everybody in this room has controlled it at certain times, haven't you? And this is what you always go back to. Well, I remember back in 1972, I said, no, that's a bit of a stretch, don't you think? When you can go back and remember the one time you set out to drink one beer and did it, the second piece it starts talking about, guys, on page 24, and it says, this is the most controversial stuff I talk about from the podium. It says one thing and one thing only. It says that we are without defense against the first drink. Can you choose to stop and make it stick? What's your truth based on your experience? God, I wish somebody in 1981 had sat down with me and asked me these questions. They didn't. They asked me how many DWIs I'd had, how many times I'd been arrested. Did I black out? Did I piss my pants? What are you, nuts? No, of course not. That's why I don't subscribe to this stuff that we hear people in our meetings talking about, the stupid yet. Oh, but those things haven't happened to you yet. And I'm sitting there, you know, thinking, you know, buddy, I'd commit suicide before those things would happen to me. They'll never happen to me because I'm not like you. Instead, we could have gone back to the literature and said, Chris, old buddy, were there times you drank more than you intended? Yeah. Were there times that you said that you'd stop and didn't pull it off? Yeah. You're suffering from a disease called alcoholism. About 15% of this country is suffering from it, and it's going to kill you if you don't get well. Now, buddy, that's a first step experience. That'll bring you full circle. Forget the stupid drama. We got people killing people all over this town, talking their stupid war stories from the podium. Talking their stupid war stories. You know what? You know where you need to tell your war story? Anybody want to jump out there and guess? Book tells you. 12-step call. If you're making a 12-step call, go armed with your stories so you can help that person identify. If you're sitting in an AA meeting, shut up. How dare you tell a war story in a meeting? Let me put it another way. Who the hell do you think you are? Telling that war story in that meeting. Do you know everybody in that meeting? Do you know what they've been through? You're just going to take a chance that somebody can identify with what you're saying. We've got the solution. Exactly what alcoholism is and how to recover from it. But we're not going to get around to that because you're going to tell your stupid, weak war story one more time. As I bore you with the time that I crawled into a dumpster to get my dinner in 1976, the nice professional woman on the front row will get up, get her purse, and leave. Because she can't relate to that. And I talk about how many times I've been arrested. The young adults will all start giggling, get up, go get coffee, because I've lost them. You know, folks, my intentions were good. What I was trying to do was help you identify. But you see, the book doesn't say in the first 60 pages, if you want to help an alcoholic, tell them your stupid stories. It says on a 12-step call, if you're trying to get somebody that knows nothing about the fellowship and want to get them interested, share a few stories about yourself, get them pumped up about this thing, let them identify a little bit, then bring them to a meeting and share the solution. We're too busy over and over and over trying to scare the newcomer into recovery. That's why it's not working. How do we know it's not working? Absolutely. Look at the statistics. We just asked you one more time. How many of you cats in here have relapsed? Raise your hand. Most of the room. That's why it's not working. I've got a hospital that's full of people. There's about five of those people in the hospital right now that I did the stats on Friday. Five of those people are brand new in the fellowship, have never been to AA before. The rest of them, they've been to AA before. Why haven't they been able to stay sober? Bullshit. Because they're not hearing the solution in the meetings. What they're hearing is more war stories. Friends, please, we know how to get drunk. We know how to make fools of ourselves. We know how to do stupid things. We know what the pain is like. Can you tell me? Can you do me what the chapter I just read out? Pull me with a vision of how cool life's going to be in sobriety. Can you give me some hope so I don't walk out of this room and commit suicide? Folks, alcoholics and addicts drink because we have a thing inside called a spiritual sickness. And it talks about it quite clearly in the book. On three or four pages, on page 52, one of them, and on page 64, it says another one. It says real clearly that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. But until the spiritual malady is overcome, we're not going to get well. And no human can fix the spiritual malady. God fixes the spiritual malady. That's the only reason we work the steps, folks, is to get connected to God. You think this is some kind of stupid self-help program? It is not. It's a spiritual program of action where men and women help each other stay on the spiritual path by working the steps. If you are in this room and you are not actively working the steps, you are not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're in the fellowship, and you wonder why your life is so unsatisfactory. You wonder why you continue to have troubles, why you can't stay sober, why you're at constant odds with everybody around you. Because you're not working the steps. In 1987, after a suicide attempt, folks, I'm in and out of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have picked up, I don't know how many desire chips. The depression is killing me. I'm taking a dozen antidepressants. I don't know how many pills. At one time, I was taking 8 pills a day, antidepressants. I was working for my twin brother in a binder they've got there. He was letting me work out in the warehouse. If it hadn't been for him, I'd have been on the street because I couldn't hold down a job anymore. Alcohol was kicking my butt. Beer. Couldn't stop. Could stop short periods of time. And then the internal condition would become so uncomfortable, my mind would say, Chris, you gotta drink or die here, buddy. And I'd start drinking again. And physical allergy would kick in again, and I couldn't control how much, and I'd be drunk again. And that was the route. And I just couldn't keep doing it. And in 1987, I went home. I'll never forget that night. It was a cold November night. And I went home. I remember I tried to call Myers to tell him I was leaving. No furniture. No personal belongings. I got a little place to live. Thank God for that. And I went to that apartment. It was colder than hell in there. Didn't even bother to turn the heat on. I went straight to the medicine cabinet and got all those pills out and drank me a bottle of Black Label and those pills because I was going to go bye-bye. Halfway through that process, I heard this little voice. I've said it 1,000 times. I have no idea what I heard. I heard God say, somebody say, the next door neighbor say, who knows, don't do it. Go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember verbally saying that night, Alcoholics Anonymous, those losers, if I never sit in another meeting and listen to a bunch of people sitting around whining about their problems again, it'll be too soon for me. And I heard the voice again, go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. The next night, I walked into a group up in Louisville, Texas, cold November night. I've told the story 1,000 times. I walked in the back door, folks. They were all carrying big books, and they were all talking about God and the steps. I've had some people in those meetings say, Chris, that's not the way it came down. That's exactly how I remembered it. Jim was there later on. Within a few weeks, I met Jim and some of the other cats that are in this room. Mike Barnes, the man-to-man conference that first year. I'm going to tell you something, folks. The people in this room absolutely changed my life. Those steps saved my life. Those people got around me that night and they said, Chris, you're going to recover from alcoholism and drug addiction if you will try to do the work. And I said, you can't recover. You're always going to be recovering. And he said, Chris, old buddy, it's time that we got something real clear. Bill Fields was the guy. Up to this point, you've played in this program. And we're going to tell you now how this thing works. The book says that you're going to recover. Millions of us have recovered. You can too. Even as arrogant as you are, you can too. You're less than 24 hours away from a suicide attempt, and you want to come in here and tell us what this book says, but on your own admission, you've never worked the steps. You've never done the work. You're right, you're right, you're right. Will you be willing to work the steps rapidly, and let's have a spiritual experience, and your life will change? Will you be willing to do that? Yes. Yes. There was a little 19-year-old girl that was sitting in there, and through the whole meeting, she sat right here next to me and rubbed my little knee, cleaned up my spilt coffee, and would not let me move. That's why I don't agree with segregating meetings into young adult meetings, professional meetings, men's meetings, and women's meetings. If that girl hadn't been there that night, I wouldn't have stayed. There's nothing sexual about it, folks. She loved me. She knew that she was doing her job as a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous by sitting next to this very unwholesome man, not letting him leave. That was her job. She didn't preach. She didn't talk about the book. She sat there and smelled good. It was pretty cool stuff. So, I mean, I need to tell you, she's still sober today. 2 weeks later, I'm working the steps, and I'm in my fourth step, my fourth column of my fourth step, where I get to look at my stuff. I sit in a meeting and I look at my sponsor, a guy named Don, and I look at him and I say, you know something, buddy? Something's changing in my life. And he says, no kidding. Look at yourself in the mirror. He had me get up and go to the bathroom and look at myself in the mirror. And I was blown away with what I was seeing. For the first time, and I can't tell you how long, I was laughing. I was feeling good about myself. You follow me? Thank God no old coot said anything about a pink cloud. The people in that room knew that it was God's grace, and that if I didn't get some hope and some passion pretty quick, I'd die. I went home that night. I told the story a million times. I went home in the November night, cold, like, well, nothing's as cold as it is out there right now. I can tell you, when I go speak in Edmonton, Canada, it's not that cold. I got to tell you, it's freezing out there. It was a cold November night up in North Texas, though, and I got out of my truck, and I went out, and it was an old white truck. Some of y'all remember seeing it, and sitting, leaning on one side, the shock all busted on it, and I put the tailgate down, and I was sitting on the back of that tailgate because I just couldn't walk. My legs got weak, and I said, man, something's weird here. Something's going on. And I'm looking around, and there's a 7-Eleven over here, and a Stop and Go. It's up there, I can just see it like now. There's a little shopping center, and there's a bar at the end of the thing where I used to drink, and there's a liquor store in there. There's a grocery store behind me. I'm surrounded by liquor. Y'all hear the picture I'm painting? Did you hear the treatment center say it? I'm surrounded by my triggers. The man that sold me my the other stuff that we're not going to talk about tonight lives in the apartment complex that I do. And I got to tell you something, folks. I stepped right there on the tailgate of that truck and cried like a baby. Because absolutely, without doubt, I didn't want to go get drunk. I had a pocket full of money. It was Friday. I could have gone. I could have. Nobody would have known about it. The deal was, the difference is, I didn't want to do anything. Walked back up to my apartment, cranked up some hot jazz, washed those stupid dirty dishes, made a few phone calls, stayed up half the night, hired a kite. Now, folks, if you want to call that a pink cloud, that's fine. What I choose to think of it is absolute God's grace. God was giving me a glimpse of what I had missed for 18 years. Some of you cats out here, you know, bust my ass, you know, about this passion. You know, Chris, you sound like a preacher coming from that podium. You know, I think possibly what we need in this fellowship is a few more people sounding like preachers from the podium. You know, I think I come to Primary Purpose. Well, I come to Primary Purpose and I listen to you guys share at the meetings and I watch you get excited and I go to Homeward Bound with you guys and I watch you carry a message of hope to the people that are in there in the state-funded facilities and I watch you get excited and you're talking about God and what God's doing for you, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, geez, if I'd have heard that message, maybe I'd have gotten sober too, you know, but that's not the message I heard. What I heard was a bunch of therapy talk talking about what we needed to do to get in a better position so we didn't have to drink. I got to say it again before I knock this podium over. You absolutely cannot organize your life out here so that you can stay sober in here. It's an inside job. What happens, folks, if you get sober and he doesn't come back? What happens if you get sober and she leaves? I'm a part of an industry that spends a lot of time trying to help people get in a better place. And I'm proud and honored to be able to do that. But that will not get you sober. If you don't get connected to a group of men and women who understand that this is about God, I think every person in this room that can afford it, even the people that can't afford it, need good therapy. I've never been a critic of therapy. What I'm trying to get you to see tonight, please, in my own bumbling way, is that Alcoholics Anonymous is not that therapy. It didn't used to be. That's why Cliff was talking about it. Our success rates were so high, because a newcomer would come to us and we would immediately get him into action, helping some other people get sober. And now we walk into meetings all over Dallas. I've heard it for years, folks. This is where I got sober. Listening to murderers tell the newcomer that they can't sponsor anybody till they've been sober a year. You can't chair a meeting until you've been sober 6 months. You can't go with us to the halfway house and carry the message of hope at the Big Book study until you've been sober 2 years. But you see, we hear it. And this is the awkward place that I'm at. Because what I get to see in the treatment centers are people who have come into our fellowship and have tried to get sober and have not been able to get sober because they saddled up next to somebody that happened to have some years under their belts who told them to take their time to work the steps. In a just world, we would kill those people. I mean, I think it's perfectly okay if you're sponsoring somebody. If you want to share your opinions with them, go ahead. But if they go absolutely contrary to what this book says, you need to pay attention to what you're saying. It is not okay. My book says we seek the solution with the desperation of a drowning man. My book says that nothing so much as ensures immunity from the obsession to drink is intensive work with other alcoholics. I don't need to worry about having a slip 2 years into this deal. I'm on solid ground and I'm making a little money and getting laid on a regular basis and life is pretty good. What I need to worry about early on in the first couple of weeks is that. I need to worry about the obsession that's with me practically nonstop. How's that obsession going to go away? Meeting makers make it. No, they don't. Meeting makers sit in meetings until they gradually can't stand the pain of just being dry one stupid day at a time. And then they go out there and shoot somebody. That's what happens. They go straight out and get some pills. They go straight out and get some alcohol, and they're gone. The people that stay sober are the people that get excited about going to work with another alcoholic. Have you found your job in AA yet? Some of you have. Some of you I look out here and know with tears in my eyes is you have found the job and you're executing it admirably. And maybe that job is making coffee and maybe that job is setting up early. I don't know what your job is, but if you haven't found it, you're not going to stay in this fellowship. And you know what you're going to do? The same thing I see so many people in North Texas do. In all the big cities, we have this thing called professional lurkers, right? And they're meeting makers, and they go from one meeting to another meeting to another meeting, and they never pick a home group, and they never get a sponsor, but they're very, 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 very vocal. And they'll be the first one to share everything they know about the fellowship. Well, my sponsor said that. I don't give a good, what your sponsor said. What I care about is what the first 164 pages. This is the bullshit sifter right here, folks. If it doesn't say it in this book, you need to forget it. And if you're bringing that into meetings and you're sharing something that you think might help somebody and it's not in this book, you need to pay attention to what you're doing. Because you're killing people with your opinions. Again, I'm going to say it, folks. Have I done it? Yes. Has everybody in this room done it? Yes. This is why people get so uncomfortable when I speak like this. Because all of us have done it. What I'm asking us to do as a fellowship, let's do what Bill Wilson said. Let's start looking at our own inventory. We take the steps, to get well. We use the traditions to keep the groups well. Let's start all of us taking our own inventory and seeing what we're doing in these groups. Are we carrying the message out of this book? Are we coming into meetings just talking about your stupid problems? I'm going to tell you something, folks. I spent some time. I did a big deal out of CA out in Phoenix. It was a Cocaine Anonymous World Service conference, and I happened to be a cocaine addict also. And I did this conference, and it was 3,000 people in the audience, and 500 of them got up in the middle of my talk and left. And I understand, because I'm giving them the same kind of talk right now, and it made a bunch of people very, very, very uncomfortable. There's a lot of people not working the steps in that fellowship too. You with me?
I made a commitment after that that I wasn't going to speak quite as forcefully about this again because I got my feelings hurt. Don't know what to tell you, folks. I got them. You know, and some of your comments cut to the quick. I love everybody in this room, and it's not my intention to ever make you uncomfortable. It is my intention to help you see that what you think you might be doing to help the newcomer might be killing the newcomer. What we need you to do is to finish working the steps with the sponsor, have a spiritual experience, and take that awakened spirit back into our fellowship and help us turn the tide. You're killing people by the gazillions out there. Does that make sense? Let me read something to you, and I'll let you out of here. Bless you. Thanks, Mom. Somebody sent me this. It was a great little deal. It's an excerpt in a little book, Asbel Steed, that some of y'all might be familiar with. It's a pretty cool little book, and I happen to like it. It's an excerpt of Bill Wilson's writings and letters and correspondence over the years. It says, AA in two words. It was written in 1967. It says, all AA progress can be reckoned in terms of just two words, humility and responsibility. Our whole spiritual development can be accurately measured by the degree of adherence to these magnificent standards. It is by them that we are enabled to find and do God's will. Can y'all get down with that? Let me read that last sentence again. It is by them, the humility and the responsibility, that we are enabled to find and do God's will. When I finally came back in 1987 and humbled myself in front of that group and humbled myself in front of the people that had been before me and said, my way's not working. No kidding. Your way seems to be working. You seem to be able to pay your bills and make a living, and some of you actually seem to be getting laid on a regular basis, and I think this is a cool thing, and you're not drinking on a daily basis, so I think I want to try to do what you do. And they started telling me to do some things that I didn't want to do. Any of y'all ever been there? This is not a program of convenience, folks. And when those people started asking me to do certain things, I didn't want to do it, and I tried to back out. And the guys brought to my attention this second piece of this thing called responsibility. They said, Chris, you came into this fellowship on your own volition. You can leave on your own volition. But while you're here, you're going to be a responsible member. That means when the hand of AA reaches out, you're going to be there. That means when you're sitting in a group like this or any other group in anywhere and a little newcomer comes up and sits next to you and he's looking uncomfortable and you look away, shame on you. You're not being responsible. Where's the hand? Where's the hand? You know, the newcomer, he didn't know where the coffee is. He doesn't know where the bathroom is. And he doesn't know where the predators are. Every group's got their predators. He doesn't know where the people are that are not looking out for his best interest. Perhaps you could stay there for a minute and help guide him. Maybe you could do for that man or woman what that 19-year-old girl did for me 14 years ago. Maybe you could be responsible enough to sit and stop hiding behind your smarmy, weak excuses that you're not sober long enough to help somebody. I can't even help myself. How can I help him? Now you're starting to get it, you know. I don't help myself. It's by turning around and helping somebody that I don't want to help that God helps me. God asks you to do one thing. God asks you to plow the damn field. Y'all understand that? Can y'all get down with what Bill Wilson's trying to say here? Your job is to plow the field. God will make the plant grow. You just plow the field. The problem is in Alcoholics Anonymous today, we got a lot of people trying to make plants grow. We got a lot of people trying to reinvent the wheel and do all the guru stuff. We need some people ready to plow the fields. Where are you going to take a meeting to today? Are you doing any 12-step work at a facility in your area? You're not? Why not? Are you volunteering down at Intergroup to answer the phones or dust the shelves or do anything that you can do to possibly be of any use to this fellowship? Because I'm going to tell you something. Jim and Mike and some of the others in this room, we go to a thing called it's a men's conference, a man-to-man. It was patterned after a woman-to-woman conference. It's one of the greatest conferences that I've ever been to, and I go to it every year. I'm not plugging this conference, although it's in Maine if you want to go and see me after the meeting, but I happen to be chairing this year. But let me tell you what we get to see in this thing. I've been going to this meeting about 14 years now, and what we've started to see, it just caught me about 4 or 5 years ago, is that we're seeing a lot of people die. A lot of these cats are dying drunk.
And a lot of them are just old and they're going away. My question to this group tonight, my question to every alcoholic that's visiting this group tonight is, who in the hell is going to pick up the slack? Dr. Bob's daughter passed away a couple of weeks ago. Some of our last ties to Alcoholics Anonymous are going away. Who's picking up the slack? Who's going to grab the plow and start doing what the people before us did? Bill Wilson took a chance in 1935 and contacted a cat because he knew he needed to give a message away. And Dr. Bob got sober. And the next day, after the story goes, after June 10th, after Dr. Bob had his last drink, they went out and found alcoholic number 3. Pretty uncomfortable business. They were kind of feeling their way through this. But because these two men did this, and they got alcoholic number 3, and then they went 4 and 5. And because they did that, folks, please, I'm alive today because somebody got off their butt and did the work. Because that girl at 19 years old was there to hold my hand through that meeting. I'm here today. Because Cliff started this group. There's been thousands of alcoholics and addicts' lives spared. And what we're seeing now is the tip of the iceberg. You think for a second, folks. Every week, the people that I try to get into treatment, they can't come because their insurance won't pay for it. This thing that happened at 9/11... Folks, September 11th, when we had a little bombing, little incident in New York, it changed everything in this country. It changed the way insurance companies pay things. Y'all follow us? And a lot of you cats think that you can just come to treatment anytime you want. You're not going to be able to come to treatment. Who in the hell is going to help your kids when they need treatment? When they need help? When the crack monster gets them? Alcohol gets them? When the pills get your wife? When they need help? Who's going to do it? You back here playing grab ass in the coffee room? No. It'll be the people that come in early and set the chairs up. It'll be the people that watch that door and wait for somebody that looked just like me walk through the door, still smelling of the street. It'll be them. There'll be a few of us always doing the work. This fellowship will never die. But the complexion will change so much it will be ineffective if we don't get some more soldiers in the trenches with us. Stop, please, please stop worrying about what the person next to you thinks. Stop worrying about what your family thinks. Make a commitment to a home group. Stand for something. The only thing that we know that will change the face of alcoholism is this fellowship. In 1987, the desire to drink left me. 14 years ago, I'll say this and be quiet. The same freedom from alcohol stayed with me all this last year. I just finished a little DIVORCE thing, and a lot of y'all knew my wife, know her.